Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Geeta Kothari. A two-time recipient of the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts Award for Literature, Geeta Kothari writes fiction and nonfiction. Her work has appeared in Best American Essays, New England Review, the Massachusetts Review, and The Journal. Her recent publications include the short story Missing Men, last year in the Kenyon Review, and the essay Thirst, forthcoming in the fall issue of Fourth Genre. Welcome to Prosody, Geeta.
Hi, Ellen.
Hi. How about you start tonight by reading from an essay?
Okay. I'm going to read from Thirst. And I'm going to start with, there are two epigraphs at the beginning. And the first one is from a book called Bombay by Dom Moraes. By the time the first small British community was established in Bombay, five of the original seven islands were already interconnected at low tide by shallow sandbanks silted up over the years. By 1730, land reclamation carried out under supervision of the British had permanently united the five islands into a single mass, and large earthworks had been thrown up to prevent a major invasion by the sea. And then the second epigraph is from India, The Land and Its People, by Swarn Kanthpur. The people living on these islands were mainly fishermen. They worshipped the goddess Mumba Devi, after whom Bombay is named. Gradually, the shallow waters between these islands were filled so as to connect the seven islands into a large one. In the photo, my father stands in front of a blooming red hibiscus framed by pink bougainvillea. The sun bleaches the ground beneath his feet, makes the leaves of the hibiscus shine as if they have just been polished. Holding his arms out from his sides, my father is a bird about to take flight. He wears gray suit pants, a short-sleeved shirt, and a dark blue tie, his idea of vacation wear. In his left hand, he clutches a clear plastic bag that probably contains maps and brochures. His curly black hair springs from his head in mild shock, and he smiles widely, his eyes hidden by square-framed glasses. Or does he? I always thought my father was just smiling until a friend saw the photo and dubbed him Laughing Man. Of course he was laughing, his mouth wide open, his teeth showing slightly. He laughed more than he smiled, the smile itself a prelude to a deep belly laugh brought on by something my sister or I said or did. And I felt embarrassed standing next to my friend, as if I should have known my father was laughing, not smiling, should have heard the familiar guffaw. I had been looking at the wrong thing, the arms like wings, weighed down only by the bag in his left hand. Although Bombay is a city that starts work late in the day, we rarely slept past six. The screeching coil, the incessant cawing of crows, and the tinkle of bicycle bells as people made their way to work woke us up every morning at sunrise, despite the closed windows and the air conditioning. In those early hours of the morning, we often heard the picker sifting through the garbage for plastic bottles. Above the cacophony of street noise and wildlife, I heard the early morning call to prayers issued over a loudspeaker from the mosque down the road. The men in the alley continued to reclaim the bottles we may have discarded the night before. "They're looking for your bottles," I said. My husband, a firm believer in recycling, did not like to crush the empty Bisleri bottles we discarded. He did not share my concerns about the way these bottles would be recycled. Bottled water, especially in rural areas, is not trustworthy. Recycling the empties by filling them with tap water and resealing the cap is a business that starts with the picker who sorts through the mounds of garbage and sells the old bottles to a middleman, who refills and distributes them as new. My husband's guidebook suggested that our fears about tap water, in the cities anyway, were exaggerated, that the worst we could expect from it was a minor dose of diarrhea for a couple of days. For my father, illness was never minor. Growing up in pre-penicillin, pre-vaccine India, he had seen people die from unexplained fevers, unidentified infections, mysterious aches that never went away. Grandparents who died from bubonic plague, cousins who died from dehydration brought on by a dose of amoebic dysentery. The guidebook had no such stories. Its pages did not talk about people like my cousin and her husband, both doctors, and their kids, who got so sick on their last visit to Bombay they had to use IV drips. My father assumed that we understood the seriousness of IV drips, even if we didn't know what was in them, and that had they not been doctors, my cousin and her family would have died. The clincher, which my father saved for last, was that they ate no outside food, that is, food prepared and sold on the street or in a restaurant, and they drank only bottled water. Obviously, my father said, a hint of triumph in his voice, the water they were drinking was fake. To forestall the impending threat of contaminated water, my father decided during our Zurich stopover that we would save our small plastic water bottles and take them to India, where we would refill them at the hotel with water from bigger bottles purchased locally. Their purity established by unbroken seals, my father would check and recheck. During our 2 days in Zurich, he amassed a large collection of 16-ounce bottles, argued when my mother suggested he leave some behind, and extolled the bottle's virtues to my husband and me when we talked about buying new bottles in India. This plan so clearly assuaged his anxiety, we stopped arguing and allowed him to take charge of hydrating us.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Geeta Kothari. So, Geeta, I want to ask you, and it's something I noticed particularly in this essay, but it's in your other work that I've read, I've noticed it as well, and I'm going to try to make an intellectual leap. We'll see if I can actually do this into kind of a larger scope, and it has to do with a voice that's grappling with identity. And a voice in particular grappling with kind of first generation identity. And why I bring that in is I think, you know, some of the other voices that I've read that kind of deal with it from, let's say, a generation ago, that first generation identity had to do more with kind of embarrassment with their parents' kind of old fashioned ways and not assimilating to the United States and, you know, that kind of thing. And this, your voice is a very contemporary first generation voice in the sense that it's not the concerns of migration anymore as much as it really is about identity and about information. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, you know, the migration was never complete, I think. And I think that's the case for a lot of contemporary first generation people in the sense that with the information age, the jet age, all of these things change the way we relate to our home countries. So I had a very, very strong relationship with India or the idea of India. And my parents deliberately fostered that. And so it just becomes a little, I think it's a little more complicated. It's not so simple that this is American, this is Indian, or even that this is Indian American. And even as, you know, as I began writing these essays, I realized I wasn't even quite sure what Indian meant, you know, particularly in my context where my parents came from two different parts of India, different groups culturally, different religions. So there was just nothing fixed. And I think one thing I try to do in my essays, or at least have tried, I don't know if I'll keep doing this, but is to suggest the fluidity of identity. So yeah, there are times when I may be grappling with the embarrassment my parents wrought on me.
I think we all do that.
Yeah, but I think that's just, you know, it's something that I think a lot of people go through. And so for me, part of it is identity and part of it is just that, you know, they were my parents and they were embarrassing.
And we all can relate to that. But interesting in the sense that, you know, the extra complication. Did your parents meet here?
They did. And that also is very complicated and difficult to explain, which kind of also explains why I do this in nonfiction rather than fiction, because the apparatus for explaining that would just take a novel, whereas in nonfiction, I can cut straight to the chase. My mother was here for 10 years. She worked at the UN. My father came on a Fulbright. They were set up by friends, non-Indian friends, who one of set of whom turned out to be my godparents. And that was it. You know, I'm not sure they understood the turn their lives would take or that they even understood they would stay here for the rest of their lives. So it wasn't even as deliberate as that. And they met in the 60s when there were just very, very few Indians in this country. So a lot of my essays grapple with that of sort of growing up isolated from other Indians. I mean, even though we grew up in New York, we were not part of any of the small sort of groups there. And that was complicated by my mother being a professional woman at a time where very few women held the kind of professional job she had, and very few Indian women did. So there's just all these levels of complication.
Plenty of material for being a writer.
It's just a good thing I became a writer.
Exactly. This is what you need in order, these kind of layers. And I'm sure it's also complicated by the fact that your parents had different views of what it meant to be Indian.
Yeah, they did. And they weren't exactly clear. It wasn't like, you know, it only becomes clear in the writing that I say, oh, this is where they were telling us this is how you be Indian. But a lot of it was implicit.
Mm-hmm.
And there are all kinds of reasons, too, for hanging on to that identity, you know, which I still haven't quite gotten to or come to terms with. There was a lot going on there. My parents were very unusual, and I think it was difficult for them to stay in India, given how unusual they were. They were not conformists, but right. I think it was also difficult for them to be far from their families, and they really were very attached to their families in different ways. My father in a completely different way from my mother. I would say my father much more attached to place and my mother much more attached to people. So they were very, very, I don't actually, you know, I feel like I don't know them as well as I should, you know, and I think a lot of, I mean, this essay talks about reclaiming my father, and I think that really explains a lot of what drives my writing, my personal writing about my family, is
sure.
this effort to kind of reclaim them or construct them and to remember them.
And I think that's, you know, there are kind of, well, there's many, many veins to go at it, but two strong ones I can think of is the one reclaiming them, trying to get from them whatever you feel they need to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one is debunking what you know about them. You know, they're like, well, I always thought you were this. And then you find out, oh, you were something completely different.
Yeah.
All good material for writing. So how about you read a little bit more?
Okay. I think I'm just going to read another part from the essay, which is further in. This is further in, and this is about my father. Much of the essay deals with my father, as you might have gathered. Like so many other residents of Bombay, my father was not born there. He was born in Saurashtra in the Gujarat and spent much of his childhood moving from one small town to another. His history is fragmentary, difficult to grasp, dependent on a few images. When he was 4 years old, his father, a trader, went to Africa. No one told my father, and he sat outside on the stoop of his home in Rajkot, waiting for his father to return until late in the evening when his mother finally brought him inside. When my father talked about the people who raised him, he did not talk about his father, only his mother, and the aunt and uncle they lived with in Sirdar. He talked about growing up in Gondal. He did not refer to any of these places as home, only as places in which he did not stay long enough to make friends. His older brothers, already preteens when my father was born, were as absent as their father. They were sent to live with relatives when my father was still a child. The stories about my father's past were suggestive and incomplete. His brothers fought, his mother sent them away. The events belonged together, but no one seemed able to explain them or decide what they meant. My parents acted as if everything was obvious, and if you asked a question, ventured an opinion, they just repeated what had already been said. The brothers fought. Your grandmother had to send them away, to Bombay. Sometimes, if pushed, one of them would say, she couldn't control them. My grandmother, I know only through a black and white photograph as a stern, unsmiling woman in a plain, pale sari. She told my father that boys from royal families were sent away when they were 5. Their parents did not raise them. When he was 14, she sent my father to Bombay, where his brothers lived. 738 kilometers away from his home, he lived alone in a hostel and went to school. This would be his last stop for 25 years before he went to America, and New York became his new home. About his life in Bombay, I have a few certainties. He had an office. He was the head of his department at the hospital. Away from the watchful eyes of his gin mother, he had his first sip of alcohol, his first taste of meat, his first cigarette. I gathered, without anyone stating so exactly, that he preferred the company of his friends to his brothers and their wives, though he adored his nieces and nephews. Most of his friends were dead, but when he went to Bombay more than 40 years after leaving it, there were still people who knew him, old students, their children, friends of friends. His circle was wider than I could imagine. I could have asked him for more, but my father evaded questions he didn't want to answer. He repeated the story again and again, full of holes, lacking a narrative drive. The older brothers fought, my mother sent them away. Or he would get combative, ask me why I wanted to know. Or he would simply laugh until tears came to his eyes. These children, he'd say, they know nothing. That's because you won't tell us anything. There's nothing to tell. But I did not believe him. I could not, because when he pointed to something that had significance to him, he expected me to understand its significance without knowing why it was significant. I felt like the British, putting separate islands together, filling in the spaces between them. I felt aggressive, but not victorious, just worn down by the heat and the constant work of constructing my father, putting the pieces of his life together in a way that made sense. Land reclamation is a messy business. It's a matter of forcing the pieces together, making an imperfect, swampy whole. When you step back, you see that it works, but how exactly remains a mystery. One morning, I asked my father for directions to the apartment where he lived with my uncle and his family. He told me to direct the cab to Girgaon. Girgaon? What's that? I flipped through the guidebook. Had it been renamed? In its symbolic return to Bombay's mythic pre-colonial Hindu past, had the Shiv Sena made my father's past completely out of reach? Mild panic rose in me. Portuguese church, he said with emphasis, as if this was perfectly obvious. And the apartment is there? He sighed, laughed to himself, muttered, "These children." Then he wiped his face with his handkerchief. "Turn right at the Portuguese church." He smiled and started laughing again. "Forget it, I'll take you." Once, when she was 2 years old, my sister came home to our apartment in New York after being in India for several weeks and wandered through the living room, methodically patting every item of furniture, the overstuffed couch, the low cane chairs, the long credenza against the wall, taking inventory of the place she had left behind. She bumped up against the glass-topped coffee table with its sharp edges and ivory inlay, the houseplants, two hibiscus, a straggly spider plant still in the corner by the windows. The view through the windows still the East River, mostly dark on a moonless night, except for lights from the occasional tanker sliding by. A small hand on the cold window, just to reassure herself, nothing had changed. This was my father, 30 years later, checking things off, making his rounds between Calaba and the fort, tending to memory the way a horticulturalist tends to his greenhouse. Each plant in place, carefully watered and fed, my father kept the past alive. If he noticed any changes, he weeded them out. I never caught him using the new name for Queen's Road. For him, and for me now, it is still Queen's Road, where he kept an office until he was 39 years old and went to America.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Geeta Kothari. So I wanted to talk to you about this essay in terms of it being kind of a hybrid form.
Yes.
And I know you've had people who, when you were finding a home for it, talking to you about it. And, you know, to me, there's, of course, it's memoir. It's talking about you and your father, but there's a real kind of travelogue side to it. And again, you know, I think it kind of goes back to the conversation we were having, that this is a place that is familiar and unfamiliar to you. And in particular, in this essay, you're going places that you haven't been before. So I just wanted you to talk a little bit about that hybrid form.
Yeah, I like to write essays that have lots of stuff in them, you know. So even when I think I'm going to write about one thing, for example, I think I'm going to write about my dog, I end up writing about my marriage. So much to my
natural,
husband's dismay.
Natural transition.
So this essay, it took a really long time to put together. I think working in it wasn't like I deliberately said, I want to write a hybrid travelogue memoir. It was only until I got the rejection from a journal that had solicited work from me specifically, having read my other work, that I realized what I had done. And what they said to me was, we can't accept this. This is too much of a combination or I don't even know if they use the hybrid, but it's mm-hmm. too much of a cross between a travelogue and a memoir. And I looked at it and I said, well, that's exactly what I set out to do. So I'm not going to rewrite it. Right. I'm just going to send it somewhere else who will accept it.
And was their concern just the fact that it couldn't be called one or the other?
I don't know what their problem was. We did not have further discussions about this. I figured it was their loss. I was actually kind of pleased by the rejection because I felt like it was one of those things where you read it and you think, well, that's what I set out to do. So there's not much I can do to change your mind. Right. I'm just going to find a place that's interested in genre bending or, you know, boundary bending. And, you know, it was kind of a shot in the dark when I sent it to Fourth Genre. I'd heard good things about them. I'd seen some of the essays they'd published, but it wasn't like I was thinking, oh, they're perfect home for this. It's just mm-hmm. there's so few places that publish only creative nonfiction, and I always try to go to those places first. I go to all my favorite places first, and sure. then I work my way down. So, but the hybrid, you know, it like I said, it's something I'm interested in. I'm really interested in place. So it's not like I'm necessarily interested in writing travel pieces, but I'm so interested in place, and I felt that I really wanted to write about Bombay and my father's Bombay, which, of course, I could never penetrate. Mm-hmm. You know, I could only touch the surface. And I started this essay quite some time before he died, and I was really hoping to finish it before he did die. But, you know, I wasn't thinking he'd die when he died. No one ever is. So, right. But I started it, and I could have asked him for clarifications, but it just seemed like I wanted to capture this one aspect of my dad and the sort of difficulty of being my dad's daughter in sure. this particular setting.
Well, and I think, too, you know, just the lens, I don't think the essay would have been as complex if you just captured your dad's Bombay, for the fact that it is all about that being in a place that has a different significance for you than it does for him. And, you know, in a way kind of crosses between your connection to him, which you said your mother was connected to people, and then his right. connection to place. And, you know, so I think, you know, the gaps to me in the story or the places where you rely on bits of information that could have come from a textbook or a travel brochure, that those gaps in trying to find pieces to fit into them is part of what makes the text really interesting. That kind of, let's see if we can fit that in there.
And yeah, and that is exactly how I work. It really is. Let me see if I can fit this in there. And you know, I'll just go at it and at it and at it. And you know, I think it drives my readers crazy because the earlier drafts are always a huge mess. And the earliest draft of this one was just, you know, it was like, well, where is this going and what is it doing? And I think it's a kind of style that a lot of readers don't like. It's digressive. It asks you to go to places that don't seem to fit.
Yeah. So. Well, and I think, you know, I've had conversations with students I've had recently that I think, too, there's like a difference in readership now. I don't want to be kind of, you know, blasé and just say, well, these days. But, you know, a text like this asks the reader to do a certain amount of work.
Does.
And I think there really is something that is changing about, I think there's such a transparency, and most of the time it's because it's pretty shallow information that it's like, if you don't get it right away, then you just, you know, oh, move on. And there, you know, a layered text that asks a reader to work means you got to spend some time with it.
Right. It's not like I sit down and say, oh, I'm going to make my readers work so hard to get this.
If you did that, you'd have to start talking in like the third person royal we.
Right. But it's what I enjoy writing, and I it's what I enjoy reading, too. You know, I like my share of work that doesn't ask me to do anything, you know, as we well know.
Sure.
But, you know, I think there's a real pleasure in sort of diving into a piece and not quite knowing where it's going to go. And and not knowing where it's going to end up, both for me as a writer and a reader. And if there's something I can hook onto as a reader, and so as a writer, that's why I put in those epigraphs. You know, they're not meant to be read past. They are telling you, this is what you need to think about when you're reading this essay.
See, that's the poet in you.
Yes, it is very sad. You know, I have been stealing from the poets, and I'm not sure it's something people approve of.
Well, I know poets do have a thing. They're like, they say to prose writers, well, you have plenty of publishing options. And, you know, they have this fantasy that we're all making like $1 million with all our book contracts. And so we need to leave epigraphs to them, to their kind of hallowed terrain. I'm sure Jan is yelling at the radio right now. I did want to ask you one more question, and it has to do, and I think it's a continuation of this conversation. It seems to me, and not just in this essay and some of the other essays of yours that I've read, that there's something about obstacle, like an obstacle you come up against, and you're trying to hammer at it. And is that something, you know, like when you hit something like that, do you know you've got something, or do you go, oh no, another obstacle in terms of the writing process?
It's not like I know I've got something. I just kind of go with it. You know, it's interesting because I always tell my fiction writers, my students, obstacles are your friends. You know, you want your characters to get into trouble, and it's through their response to obstacle that we learn something about them. Now, I don't consciously think that when I write nonfiction, but clearly I must have absorbed some of my own lessons, which is a good thing. So, yeah, it's more like obstacle to me is an opportunity to sort of dig in and write and to figure things out. And I feel it really in the nonfiction. There's so much figuring out that goes. I was like, I'll always think, now, why have I brought this up? Why does this need to be in here? Why? And for me, writing nonfiction, it's so much of, I rely so much on my intuition because I've had so little training in it. I mean, I didn't get an MFA in nonfiction. So in some ways, it's a less well-articulated process to me than the writing of fiction, which I teach and, you know, have been really steeped in. And so the obstacles, they come up, and I just sort of go at them. You're right, I do. And sometimes it's really like hitting a brick wall. And I'll often put pieces away for a very, very long time. I mean, this piece sat in a drawer for a long time in between drafts because I would look at it and I would say, okay, I understand there's something wrong here. I understand I'm supposed to be working through these things. I can't take them out. I can't leave them in as they are. What am I supposed to do? You know, you just have to put it away.
And we'll leave with that as kind of a cliffhanger at the end of the interview. Gita, thanks so much for coming to Prosody.
Thanks, Ellen.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Waite. Our sound engineers are Joseph Wilk and Lauren Wolf. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP. She had a smile that swerved. She had a smile that curved. She had a smile that all wrong.